And now I'd like to introduce our main speaker for the evening, Lisa from Escondido.
Hi, everyone. My name's Lisa, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you so much for inviting me here tonight. It's great to be here, and it's great to see my friends from the Attitude Adjustment Meeting and all my other friends here tonight that I don't know yet. I want to welcome the newcomers and the visitors, and I want to congratulate the people that got their tokens and their cakes tonight. Awesome, really awesome. A lot of years of sobriety there, one day at a time, and I'm really glad that you're part of this, and I appreciate what everybody shared. I'm going to tell you a little bit about what's going on right now and then roll it back to what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now a little bit more. You know, when I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was pretty sure I wasn't an alcoholic. I had never gotten shot. I had never gotten stabbed. I had never been imprisoned. So how could I be an alcoholic, you know? And I just was pretty sure I wasn't. I had lost thousands of pairs of shoes. I had lots of creditors calling day and night. I had the Oceanside police detectives at my house a few times. I poured out a lot of booze at the border in Mexico. I'd gotten stopped a few times in Mexico, but I always got away with it. So, you know, I was pretty sure I wasn't an alcoholic. And fortunately, the women, who I hated, by the way, I only liked the men, but the women saved my butt in this program. And, you know, when I first started going to meetings, I started going to the Belor meeting, was my home group up in Encinitas. And it was a great mix of people there. And the first meeting that I went to and shared that I wasn't sure if I was an alcoholic and you know, this guy Ed Pope stood up. He's about 6'2", and he never shares sitting down. He had to stand up and say, if you can't identify yourself as an alcoholic, you're not welcome to share. And I just, you know, there was all of a sudden all this drama in the room, and I stormed out, and all these women came out after me, and I thought, I love this place. I love it. You know? And I really did feel right at home. The only problem was that you scared me because I thought you were really together. I mean, you actually knew some things about yourself, and that really scared me because I didn't know much at all about myself. I had just been running. I was a runner, and as long as I was moving, I was okay. And, you know, I have to tell you that 3 months ago, my mom passed away, and my story is completely different now, so I really don't know exactly what's going to come out of my mouth, but I was sharing that with Doc, the 10-minute speaker, and, you know, it's been a very rough 6 to 7 months, and my sobriety date is March 9th, 1990, and I'm really grateful that I've been able to get here and stay sober. I'm really grateful that apparently, God willing, my bottom was low enough, and that I don't have to do what this old guy, Al, who I hated for so long at the Belor meeting, his name was Big Al, and he used to wear these suspenders and this top hat, and those suspenders before they were in style again, you know, and he'd get up and he'd share about, if somebody was whining in the meeting, he'd get up and he'd pull his wallet out and he'd throw them $3 or $4 across the room, and I just thought, you know, what a blah-de-blah, blah. And I just didn't get that at all. But, you know, over time, I stopped whining and started to grow up a little bit. But I must have whined for 3 or 4 years about my mother. And she and my ex-husband were always the top person on my resentment list. It was like a battle here. Is it going to be him or her? You know, they were to blame for everything. And, you know, it's just an amazing thing the way this program works. The surrender, I was talking about that with somebody outside just before the meeting, that it really comes from, I believe it's either Latin or Greek, to go to the winning side. That's what it means. It doesn't mean that you're a loser. And, you know, I was from Boston, and the concept of surrendering was just something that I was not brought up to do. You know, we were very proud, and you always act like everything's fine, even if you're falling apart completely. Just make it look good. And you know, I really wasn't willing to surrender for quite a while. I really did have an issue with those things that I started off with, that, you know, your stories, I always made mine sound worse, but I didn't have those things in there. You know, I really wasn't in jail. I got away with a lot of stuff. I was strip searched a few times, but, you know, none of that mattered because I got away with everything. So took a while until a sponsor, one of those women that followed me out of the room that time that Ed Pope stood up and said, if you can't identify yourself, you're not welcome to be here. One of them kind of adopted me as her sponsee. And I remember so clearly, and it was, you know, 18 years ago, she had a very young baby, and she invited me over to her house. And usually I was way too busy for something like that. But, you know, I was pretty desperate. My life was falling apart. And I went over to her house, and I remember as she was feeding her baby, she asked me some things about myself, and she asked me if I minded if she wrote them down on a little piece of paper, and I said no, I didn't mind. And so I told her some things, and she wrote these things down, and at the end of the baby's lunch, you know, she read them back to me, and I couldn't believe how pathetic they sounded. And they were my life, the stuff that was going on in my life, and I really didn't know anything about myself. I didn't know what I felt like. I just didn't know how to make decisions. I didn't know how to show up to work on a regular basis. And, you know, my life had gotten pretty horrible. But so much of my early sobriety was powered by my mother and my hatred for my mother. And thank God that through the steps, you know, I came to really love her. I came to take responsibility for my part in things. We were just like oil and water from the moment I was born. And, you know, we ended up really, really close. And I remember one day, about 6 months ago, just driving down Del Dios Highway. It was a beautiful day, and, you know, the sun was just sparkling amid the trees. And I just thought, I could just hear, call your mom because you can, because she's still alive. And she was dying of pancreatic cancer. And I called her, and, you know, for the first time I heard her say, "Hi, Dollface." I never heard that before. I could never hear the love. I never felt the love. We hated each other for so many years. And thank God for this program and for making amends, both the verbal amends and living amends in my behavior, and just learning how to be a decent daughter and showing up. You know, I was able to be there for her when she died. And my parents came out here after we learned that she was terminal, and she was still doing fairly okay. So my father had been promising her a cruise for like 40 years, and they'd never gone on one. So I convinced them to come out here from Vermont, and instead of going to the Caribbean, we were going to go on a one-week cruise to Mexico. And, you know, we never made it on that cruise. I ended up taking both my parents to urgent care the day we were supposed to be leaving on the cruise, and they were side by side in urgent care, one sicker than the other. And, wow, if I had been drinking, there is no way I could show up in my parents' life the way I have. I mean, it is just such a miracle to go from this irresponsible, whining, you know, I'm not going to say it because I'm really trying hard to tell the truth and not swear, but I wasn't worth much. I didn't like myself. I wasn't someone that had any self-esteem because I didn't do any esteemable acts. You know, I didn't act like a decent person like we're taught in this program. And so that's changed. And even though I'm not going to probably be telling a whole lot of jokes and I don't know how funny my story is going to be, I'm really, really grateful that I've taken the steps, I've stayed sober, and I've gotten to a point where, you know, I have a little resentment against someone in our 7 a.m. meeting who suggested about 8 months ago praying to be of maximum service. I'm like, oh no, I did that. That was my mistake. You know, because I mean, I have so many needy people around me right now. It's unbelievable. And, you know, I am just, my day is filled with helping others, and I'm really grateful on the one hand for it. But there's a little bit about, you know, wait, this is supposed to be fun, you know, and I'm in this really tough phase right now. And So, you know, I really hope to carry a message of hope and strength and support for any of the newcomers that are out there struggling. And especially if you're out there and you didn't raise your hand and identify yourself as a newcomer, because it took me a lot of time to actually do that. I had to keep drinking and drugging for quite a while before I admitted I was an alcoholic. And, you know, I remember going to Saturday Night Live in Encinitas. And I was just trying to get my ex-husband sober. And fortunately, his cousin's in the room today. So I know that phase of my story will be the truth, you know. Because it was great because I hadn't seen him in years. And then ran into him at the attitude adjustment meeting. And I was really grateful for that. But you know, I'll roll it back. I've always said I was born in Boston, and it turns out that, you know, my alcoholic husband helped me realize that I really, even that was a lie. I wasn't born in Boston. after we had first met, and we've been together about 15, 16 years, and we went on our first trip back to Boston because he's from that area too. He blindfolded me and he drove me someplace, and then he told me to guess where I was, and I said, I have no idea, I'm blindfolded. And he says, and you're not peeking? No, I wasn't. So he said, you're in Dorchester, right outside where St. Margaret's Hospital used to be. And I'm like, Dorchester? That's like the bad side of town in Boston, you know. That's not a place you really want to be from. And I couldn't believe I'm from Dorchester, you know. And the way the story goes is, you know, my parents were on their way to Beth Israel Hospital, and I was kicking too hard, and they had to stop at St. Margaret's, you know. I always loved hanging around with Irish people, you know, from day one. I'm pretty sure I was in the incubator there with a bunch of redheads and, you know. Anyway, you know, I grew up in Winthrop, Massachusetts, and I grew up on a block with the Muldoons and the Monahans and the Murrays and, you know, a bunch of people whose fathers were longshoremen, and a lot of drinking going on that block. And we were the Jewish family, and, you know, Jews don't drink, right? There are no Jewish alcoholics. You all know that, right? So anyhow, I just kept... As we moved, I didn't know this until I actually did my first fifth step, that I had lived in 14 different places before I graduated high school. I didn't know that because, you know, we were always running. We were always moving. My dad was not in the military. My parents were not in the military. But that's just how I learned how to deal with stuff. If you're not happy or an emotion comes up, leave. And that's what, you know, that's the way I did my life after that, too. And so I lived in Boston, outside of Boston, in Winthrop. I lived in the projects. I lived in, where did we go after that? Southern Illinois, Carbondale. I lived in Germany for a while. Lived in Florida, Chicago, all over the place. And Florence, Italy for a year. And wow, did I get that drinking going there. Those bottles of Chianti were pretty inexpensive. I could actually get a bottle for 75 cents when I lived there. Yeah, and you know, there were and you know, okay, you can relate, huh? Okay, so I didn't just drink one bottle, you know, at a time. And you know, I'm going to just say that drugs were part of my story, and I could get 8 Quaaludes for 75 cents also over the counter. And hash. There was opiated hash that was very cheap. So that was my combination there. Mostly bottles of red wine and other drugs. And what I used to do, because I like to hang with lower companions, is climb down underneath the bridges there. Because if an American got busted with any of those drugs, it was an automatic 6 years. So, you know, I used to just hide out under the bridges. What a great place for a nice young American woman to be hanging out there, right? Yeah. So I didn't even realize it until my brother pointed this out, but I was going to prep school there. I didn't even know that. It was an American international school, and, you know, again, my parents were always trying to bring us up like everything was just fine. So I was going to prep school and climbing under bridges and getting wasted. You know, didn't make too much sense. Eventually, I actually went to college. I didn't have enough credits to graduate high school, but somehow I did. I was going to drop out because I went to one-year high school in Chicago, and I loved that. There were a lot of Italians there, and there was a lot of drinking there. And I really partied in Chicago. I hung out on the south side of Chicago. I was drawn again to the lower companions and just learned all kinds of stuff there that I didn't learn in my part of town, and loved it. And I'm not going to tell you all the details. I know you're dying to hear about them. But anyway, it was pretty wild stuff that was going on, and it was, you know, a constant party. And then when I was back in my neighborhood, I was just fearless. You know, my mom was a survivor of World War II, and so she was pretty fearful of everything. She was afraid of everything, and she acted like a victim. So I did the opposite. You know, I wasn't afraid of anything. I could do anything, and I didn't need anyone. And, you know, the book talks about how that pride is just the opposite coin of fear, and, you know, how that'll bring us right back to the bottle real quickly. So that's how I kind of ran my life. And when I was back in my own safer neighborhood in Chicago, you know, I would just, a lot of young women, they'd be afraid to go home from parties on their own. So I'd walk everybody home, and then I'd run home, you know, and I'd be going through some pretty scary neighborhoods. I wasn't scared at all. I just had no fear, and I loved that adrenaline thing. I always loved that adrenaline thing. I used to dance a lot. That's how I lost a lot of shoes, you know, and I just, you know, whatever it was, and I did tumbling and trampoline, anything to get that adrenaline going when I was like 12, 13. So the first time I got drunk, I was 11. My parents had gone out, and my brother and I discovered their alcohol, and so I just was like hanging out with my brother and his friends and just getting drunk, and it was Benedictine, and man, it tasted terrible, but I loved that warmth. I still remember that first drink and the warm, burning sensation in my throat. I loved it, and I knew I was going to be okay. I really did. I've heard that story. You've probably heard it a million times, but I knew when I had that to drink that as long as I had something to go down just like that and change my thinking and my feelings in an instant, I was going to be okay. So by the time I was 12 and 13, I was drinking and doing drugs. And by the time I got to college, it's kind of a miracle I did get there, but my dad was a college professor. So in my family, if you didn't go to college, you were like out of the family. So it was always kind of a done deal that I was going to go to college. And somehow my parents talked the principal of that last school into graduating me, even though I was one credit short, because I was going to drop out. I wasn't going to go to a fourth high school. And so somehow they paved the way for that to happen. And, you know, I never appreciated that. And I'm really, really grateful that somehow they did that for me, because I definitely would have been out on the streets and I could have been dead very easily at the rate I was going. So that was my ticket to California. I did a really lousy job on all the applications except for the one to California, because that's the one I knew I wanted to go to. I wanted to get as far away from my parents as I could. So they were in Florida at the time, so 3,000 miles, San Diego. Anyway, I came out to college actually near L.A., and I was the drug dealer on campus. That's how far I had come, you know. And so, you know, then after about my first or second year there, then I met him, you know, my wonderful knight in shining armor, the guy who could drink and smoke as much as I did. He didn't mind that I, you know, lost a lot of things, a lot of shoes, some clothing, a few other things. I loved to go skinny dipping, you know, I was just pretty crazed. And he could keep up with me, and he also had a little bit of money. He was a building contractor, so I figured that was a good choice because, you know, he could keep me in the name brand tequila. That was my drink of choice. I discovered that in California. I quickly traded in the red wine for the tequila, and, you know, I thought I was really cool because I could keep up with just about anyone, and it had to be Cuervo, and I would drink the worm, you know, and all that stuff. So anyway, that relationship, I just thought it was great. I loved it. And that whole family that I married into, Irish Catholic, of course, you know, they didn't act like, they didn't feel like they had to hide their drinking. They would just, you know, it'd start to get to be around 4:30 in the afternoon, and they'd just say, let's get drunk. You know, and they'd take the booze out and they'd put it on the table, and they'd, you know, Uncle Mike would bring the big green ashtray out and he'd be smoking, and, you know, oh, the party was on. It was unbelievable. And, you know, if you weren't just drinking what Uncle Mike was drinking, you'd be okay to go out to the tree out in the corner of the yard and do whatever you did out there and then come back and rejoin the party, you know. And those just went on for, it seemed like a really long time in my life. And for a long time, it was fun. It was just great, the stuff that was going on. And then eventually, you know, one of the family members was Tom. My husband's sister's husband was the same as my brother-in-law's sister. I mean, they're, you know, the brother-in-law married the sister-in-law kind of thing. So it was a really tight family, you know. And so the party really kept going for quite a while. And I remember Tom was just an amazingly handsome guy. He was like 6'2", and tall, dark, and handsome, really intelligent, really a nice guy. And he told me some real basic stuff that I didn't like at all about, you know, how it's up to you to make your own life and quit blaming your parents and all this other stuff that I didn't want to hear at all. And, you know, he was a recovering heroin addict, and unfortunately he went back to drugs. And I remember one time that, you know, I was a little bored with the alcohol, and I thought, well, I want to see what Tom's doing. And I actually tried to get into his house, and I was pushing the door. You know, there was a lot of physical insanity and craziness that went on. I was like pushing the door. Come on, let me in. And he said, no, I'm not letting you do this. And he like pushed me out, and I thought, you know, what a blah, blah, blah. And he probably saved my life. There were two or three times I was trying to do what he was doing, and he just wouldn't let me. And a few years later, everything was getting out of control with the family. And Tom and Debbie had then, you know, moved to Las Vegas, and I heard the stories about how they were returning. First, she was, you know, working in one of the cages there with the as a cashier. And then a few months later, they were both just returning it was called the Price Club at the time, the carts there for the quarter that you could get when you return the carts. And then shortly after that, I heard that Tom committed suicide. And, you know, that was a definite eye-opener. You know how you have those spiritual awakenings? That was one. And I thought, something's wrong with that picture. Then, so I was still married, and we were in this little tiny, we had managed to buy a little tiny duplex, and I knew we were really up and coming because my building contractor husband was going to be adding a second story. So by this time I was pregnant, and nothing had been done around the second story except for a big hole had been cut out of the roof. And so one night I was trying to sleep, and I was getting pretty pregnant, and I really needed to get some sleep. And I heard a lot of laughter downstairs, and, you know, and I didn't want to miss the party, so I woke up to go see what was going on, and the man who became my ex-husband was there with a bunch of women doing a bunch of stuff on the kitchen table, and there were two birds flying around the house, you know, and I'm like, that was not another one of those moments where I still remember that, like, something is wrong here, you know. this just isn't quite normal, you know. So gradually, I got into AA through the back door. I actually started going to Al-Anon to get my husband sober. I knew there was something wrong with him. I knew there was something wrong with the picture, but I still couldn't see there was something wrong with me. So I started going to Al-Anon, and I remember my ex-husband would watch our son. He was like 2 at the time, and I'd go to meetings, and I'd come home, and every single toy from my son's toy chest would be spread out all over. Thank God the house was only 700 square feet, because it was through the bathroom, everything. I'd come home and I'd think, there's something wrong with this picture, you know. And then I'd come home from the Al-Anon meetings and the first thing I'd need to do is take a drink, you know, because I couldn't stand the way I felt after those meetings. So I started going... I started going to Saturday Night Live in Encinitas to get my husband sober. And I always felt so much better after those meetings. I don't know, I just felt a little bit of that calmness that you feel after a meeting, after somebody tells the truth, you know. And I remember there was a woman who asked me to be the 10-minute speaker, and I said, oh, no, thank you, I'm not an alcoholic, you know. And I still see her from time to time to this day, and she always says, ah, there she is, the non-alcoholic, you know. And so it took me a while, and I remember my ex-husband was not getting sober, and I just had to do something. By this time, we were separated, and I was trying to be a single mom, and I had no clue how to live life. I had still no clue how to make decisions, how to raise a son, how to be present about anything. And I remembered I felt a little better after I went to those meetings. So I started going back by myself. And I remember one night I was sitting next to a biker, big guy with tattoos all over his arms. And, you know, I was probably wearing jeans and a work shirt because I wore that a lot, but I was trying to feel together, you know, and I thought I was somehow better than he was. And not that I was judgmental or anything, but that was one of my big character defects. So I'm sitting next to this stranger, and he leans over to me, and he says, so how long have you been sober? And I said, oh, I'm not an alcoholic. And he says, well, tell me this. When did you smoke your last joint? You know, and I start going, well, let's see, I had a dude the other night, but it was only little. And when did you have your last drink? Well, I had a little bit, but I'm nursing so that I've, you know, just so much BS. It was unbelievable. And he just yelled out really loud, you're a fucking addict alcoholic, you know. I felt like the whole room heard it. It was like an E.F. Hutton commercial. You know, and I just, oh my God. But he yelled it loud enough that I could actually hear the guy. You know, I needed to hear that. I hated all that tough love stuff and the straightforwardness, but it's exactly what I needed to hear because I just, you know, anything else, I deceived myself. I was in so much denial. And after that guy said that, it just kind of sunk in, and I started going to the meetings at Bellure, and, you know, I got a sponsor, and, you know, I just had some of those little spiritual awakenings along the way that something's wrong with my life, and maybe it's not all their fault. And, you know, then I, thank God, started to be able to work the steps with some real honesty. And, you know, I'm just so grateful for the sponsors that I've had. And I'd love to be able to get up here and tell you that I've had the same sponsor, and my sponsor and my grand sponsor and my great-great-grand sponsor, they're all in this room. But that's a lie, you know. I can't tell you that. I've had different sponsors. Like I said, I hated women, so I had a lot of issues with my first few sponsors. But, you know, every single one of them have taught me something really, really valuable, every single one of them. And gradually over time, I learned that if I'm going to change sponsors, it's really important for me to go back to the other sponsor and just tell them, you know, that thank you for teaching me this, and thank you for your help with this step work. And I've asked someone else to be my sponsor now. It's really important to learn how to actually be honest with people and not burn bridges, because, like I said, I was a runner, and I would just run through people. I had no idea how to be a friend. I had no idea how to say anything that was at all scary or true. Anything true was scary, you know. And I learned how to do that in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and through my sponsors. And, you know, I remember early on one of my sponsors suggested that I go to a women's meeting. And I'm like, oh, please, not that, you know. And so I started to go, and I, of course, hated everything about it. And you know, it was in Del Mar. That was one of the only women's meetings in the North Coastal area at the time. And so there were all these women that acted like they were so rich and together, you know. And I used to call it the Diamond Club because they all had diamonds. They all had their nails done. And I would just criticize the hell out of that, heck out of that meeting. And, you know, it was so funny because about 5 years later, I had a diamond and I had nails, you know, and we just had a good laugh, my sponsor and I. And one of my best sponsors was Gracie, and she wasn't going to take on any new sponsees. She's someone that sponsors a lot of women in North County. She's got probably about, I don't know, at least 25 years sober now. And what happened is my sponsor, Rita, I'd had a sponsor for about 7 or 8 years. And Rita had actually gotten in a really horrendous accident on her bicycle, and she actually was related to the family that I divorced out of too. And I had known her; I used to party with her. And when I first saw Rita at an AA meeting, I just knew that I could actually make it. I knew I could tell her the truth because she had been there with me. She knew how much I drank and drugged. If one of us, you know, brought one, the other would bring the other, and you know, we'd be sure that we had a good mix going there. And so I knew I could count on her, you know. And she was my sponsor for, I don't know, 7 or 8 years. I really was able to tell her the truth, and she was in a very bad bicycle accident. And it's just amazing how our higher power works in this program. I had been single by then for a few years, and I remember saying, I'd actually gone out on a couple of dates, and I just couldn't stand it. I asked the guy to bring me back at 9:30. I just couldn't stand that early dating stuff. I hated that. And I remember just saying to God, okay, God, if you want me to be alone the rest of my life with my son, it's fine. I can handle it. You know, life is good. I'm grateful to be sober, and I can do this thing. And a few days later, I met my husband, Gary, at a meeting at the Encinitas Fellowship. And we had just started our relationship. And he happened to be over, I think it was maybe the second or third time that he was over at my house, when the phone rang, and I got the word that my sponsor, Rita, had been in a really terrible bicycle accident. She was riding down 101, and a couple dogs jumped out of a pickup truck, and she wasn't wearing a helmet then, and she went flying over the handlebars, and there was blood dripping out of her ear, and, you know, she was in intensive care. And she was one of my, you know, most important people in AA. I mean, she was really holding me up through my divorce, through a lot of stuff that was going on back then. That was when the Oceanside Police Department was coming and inquiring as to whether or not I was involved in interstate trafficking and sex swapping and a bunch of other stuff that my dear husband was doing at the time. And, you know, it was really an unbelievable shock. And Gary just happened to be over when I got that phone call. And, you know, the way this program works is absolutely amazing. And I could get off the phone and hang up the phone. And I remember turning right to him, and he was right there. And we just hugged for the longest time. And, you know, once again, I knew that the people in this program, the people in this fellowship, were going to, you know, help me make it through this. And that's when I asked Gracie to be my sponsor. And she told me she had just decided yesterday that if anyone else asked her to be her sponsor, she was going to say no. But yes, she would be my sponsor. And I remember how much time she spent with me, making available, I think it was about 8 hours, for me to do a fourth and fifth step with her, like I've never done before. And, I mean, it was really gut-level honesty. It was truly amazing, the rigorous honesty that she helped me get to. And I'll never forget that. I was so shocked that somebody would give that much time to me, because I still felt pretty useless. I think I'd been sober a few years, but I still didn't feel good about who I was. And she helped me so much with that fourth and fifth step. And one of the most important things she did, and she was Irish Catholic too, she helped me reconnect with my religion. I had run so far away from my religion, I didn't want to have anything to do with that dark history, that victim crap. I didn't want to be Jewish. And, you know, here she was, Irish Catholic, and she's one of the few people that, you know, when people tell those jokes about recovering Catholics, she actually doesn't laugh. And I remember one time, one of the reasons I asked her to be my sponsor is because at the Bellore meeting, someone had told this really off-color joke, and I found myself laughing with the whole room and then thinking, wait, this isn't funny. And I'm looking around, everyone's laughing, but I caught her eye and she wasn't laughing. And there was something that attracted me to that. And so I asked her to be my sponsor, and she helped me a lot. And she really helped me get reconnected with my religion, even though she wasn't that religion. And we didn't talk about a lot of the details of the religion. It was just one of the steps along the path of spirituality for me. And, you know, this book is all about how we recovered and sharing exactly how we recovered and how we find a power greater than ourselves that we can lean on through all the calamities and through all the problems and get sober. And it says it's, you know, it's going to tell us precisely how to do it. And I'm so grateful for the steps in the traditions and for this book. And I used to hate it. I thought it was old-fashioned. It needed some editing. You know, it was just... And I'm so grateful that I was asked to speak tonight because, like I said, it's been very tough lately. You know, since my mom died, I've encouraged my dad to stay out here. And, you know, he's basically losing his mind. I mean, he's only 78, but he is really, I don't know whether he has Alzheimer's or dementia or what it is. He's not a drinker. My mom was the drinker. But, you know, it's been very, very tough. It's a whole new responsibility. And once again, I'm so grateful that I can show up and be of service. And we get to be of service to other alcoholics and to others in our world, to our family. You know, we get to show up like we never did before. I mean, there was a reason I moved 3,000 miles away, and it's absolutely amazing that now I'm really working hard to get my dad to stay out here. Not that it's the most fun, you know, but I really want to make those living amends. I've learned that that's what this thing is about, is showing up in people's lives and doing that. And, you know, today I actually put him on a plane, and I'm praying really hard because he's supposed to arrive at 11:45 Eastern time, which is about the time I'm finished speaking. And I'm hoping he made his plane change okay, and then he makes it there. And my parents' home just sold. And, you know, like I said, we moved around a lot of times, so I never really had a home base to come back to. But this home of theirs in Vermont was the closest I ever had to a home. So on Friday, I'm going to be joining him up there and clearing out my parents' house. And this is tough stuff. You know, this is really tough stuff. And I get to do it sober. And I think it was a week or two ago, I was really being hard on myself because I was just feeling like, girl, you got 18 years. You should be better off than this. You know how we do that to ourselves? I was thinking, I shouldn't be going through so much pain. This shouldn't be so difficult. I'm sober all these years, and I've done the steps and blah, 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 and I've got a higher power. But I'm not real connected. I have to be honest with you right now. I'm not feeling real connected. I've had, actually, I'd say the past 3 years before all this started to happen, I was like on a pink cloud for like 3 years. I was feeling so good. I think I hardly ever whined in meetings anymore, although somebody might disagree with that. But, you know, as I recall, I was sharing truly experience, strength, and hope. I was feeling life was good. You know, I actually held down a job for 14 years. Can you imagine that? I couldn't hold a job for more than a year, and then I'd have to take what little bit I saved up and go run somewhere, usually down to where I could get booze cheaper, you know. But I was really feeling like this program was working and that now I had arrived. And, you know, reading the book again, it talks about how it's in the 11th step. I think it's in actually the 12 and 12, how we get to be on those pink clouds even with some time and even while we're doing the 10th, 11th, and 12th step, even after we've done that, the rigorous work at the beginning, and now we're on that, you know, promptly making amends and seeking through prayer and meditation to maintain that conscious contact and practicing these principles in all our affairs, we get lumps. I love that. You know, we have to face our lumps. Those are the words they used. And it is like, I feel like I have a lump in my throat, you know. But I was talking to someone before the meeting, and the cool thing about a lump is you feel like eventually you can actually swallow it and live, you know. And that's kind of how I am right now. I mean, I wish I could be a little more, everything's great and everything's wonderful. But the truth is, this is a really hard time in my life right now. But what happened is I went to a meeting a couple of weekends ago feeling really bad, made myself do the basics, read the book, you know, call the sponsor, call the sponsees, you know, find out how somebody else is doing. Just to pick up the phone and say, how are you, gets me out of myself. And, you know, do some writing. You know, someone suggested that I write every night before bed. What a brilliant idea, you know. I started doing that again. I had gotten away from that. And praying on my knees, which was something I would never do because of, I'm not that religion, you know. No, I'm not getting on my knees. When I get on my knees, it still really helps. It just reminds me not to take myself too seriously and that, you know, I'm just a regular garden variety alcoholic. And I did not believe that for years. It took me about 18 years to believe that. That, you know, and Mo, who started off at the attitude adjustment meeting when it was at Convoy, another guy I couldn't stand. I used to hate it when he'd say, I'm one of God's kids. I love the guy. That is so true. I love that now. There were most of the people that I hated were saying the truth. You know, what they were saying was something I didn't want to hear because it was the truth. And as I look back at all the people that used to irritate me, there was a guy named New York Joe, and he was one of my mentors in the program too. He was about my height, and I loved that. You know, so we could have eyeball-to-eyeball conversations. And at first I hated him, though, because, you know, I was from, I have to say, Boston area, to tell the truth. And and he was from New York, and that's like, you know, that's like oil and water, too. You know, you got the Yankees and Red Sox, et cetera. So I really didn't like him, but he shared some stuff that just touched my heart. And he would stick around after the meetings and, you know, we'd start to get to know each other. But he'd share during the meetings that, you know, he was a pig and he'd take whatever you had and more and all this stuff. And we're all pigs. And I thought, I'm not a pig. I'm Jewish. I'm not a pig. You know, how can I be a pig? You know. Anyway, I eventually grew to love this guy. And I got to say, I was a pig, you know, I really was. Whatever you had, I wanted it. I didn't even need to know what it was, if you were drinking, whatever, I wanted it. And some of the other people that have really, really made a difference in my life, there was a woman named Marty. She was the cake lady in Encinitas. And, you know, I never felt like she shared anything brilliant. I didn't think so what? She made cakes all the time. Honest to God, that's how I thought. And, you know, when she died, I just realized, God, I really miss Marty. I really miss the cake lady. And I started making cakes. And for a few years, I would make cakes for every Saturday meeting and bring them to the meeting. That's how I have to learn. I'm so thick-skulled, you know. And the book talks about how we're defiant in nature. You know, and every time I read that, I go, I am not defiant. You know, every time, even now when I admit it out loud, when I read that in the book, I go, not me, you know, and it just makes me crazy. But there have been some great people along the way. And, you know, I want to read a couple of things out of the book that a couple of my favorite lines out of the book, because I'm still not very good at memorizing them. We are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying on God. We are in the world to play the role He assigns. Just to the extent that we rely on our higher power, does He enable us to match calamity with serenity? Depending on our Creator is the way of strength. It talks a lot about how we alcoholics play the double life, and that was so true for me. In fact, I had three or four different faces that I put on, and it took so much energy to keep up those different faces, you know, and to make sure that whatever lie I told over there, I didn't tell it over there, and keep my story straight. What a relief to be free of the bondage of self and to be able to be the same person here or anywhere I go. And I was talking with Felix before the meeting about, you know, being sent out of town for work. What an amazing thing. Every time I have just the dream job right now, too. I just got a new job in January, and they actually sent me to the Czech Republic, Poland, and Israel. I mean, how does that happen? Do they know who they're sending thousands of miles away? And they're expecting me to show up for the things that I'm supposed to do there and come back on time. I mean, you know, that was amazing. And before my mom got really, really sick, Gary and I went on a cruise to Italy, Greece, Spain, and Croatia. I mean, I've been to 7 foreign countries in a year. Is that amazing? And there's been this really, really painful stuff. But at the same time, I mean, the joy that I have had this year is unbelievable. And the joy of living is what the 12th step is all about. So, you know, I'm just so grateful to be clean and sober. And I am going to read something that I had picked out in here from the 12th, step 12. We no longer strive to dominate or rule those about us in order to gain self-importance. We no longer seek fame and honor in order to be praised. When by devoted service to family, friends, businesses, or community, we attract widespread attention and are sometimes singled out for posts of greater responsibility and trust, we try to be humbly grateful and exert ourselves the more in a spirit of love and service. True leadership, we find, depends upon able example and not upon vain displays of power or glory. Still more wonderful is the feeling that we do not have to be specially distinguished among our fellows in order to be useful and profoundly happy. Not many of us can be leaders of prominence, nor do we wish to be. Service gladly rendered, obligations squarely met, troubles well accepted or solved with God's help, the knowledge that at home or in the world outside, we are partners in a common effort. The well-understood fact that in God's sight, all human beings are important. The proof that love freely given surely brings a full return. The certainty that we are no longer isolated and alone in self-constructed prisons. The surety that we need no longer be square pegs in round holes, but can fit and belong in God's scheme of things. These are the permanent and legitimate satisfactions of right living, for which no amount of pomp and circumstance, no heap of material possessions could possibly be substitutes. True ambition is not what we thought it was. True ambition is the deep desire to live usefully and walk humbly under the grace of God. Thank you, and I hope you all stay sober.